Also ich denke, wir können so langsam anfangen. Könnte irgendjemand die Tür vielleicht zumachen? Ja? Danke. Also willkommen in die, ja, das ist die letzte Sitzung, denke ich mir, in der Reihe. Und normalerweise würde Maria Wolf hierher kommen, um ein paar Grußworte zu sagen, aber sie ist heute Abend verhindert und daher müssen sie sich mit mir auseinanderkommen. Also ich hätte sowieso was gesagt, aber jetzt betrete ich auch noch die Maria Wolf. Ja? Und da der Jim Cote so gut wie kein Deutsch versteht, soweit ich weiß, stimmt das? Ja. Werde ich sofort die Sprache wechseln, möchte Ihnen eine sagen, aber ich werde mir Mühe geben, langsam und deutlich zu sprechen und das wird der Jim auch tun und das werden auch Helmut Fendes und Pier Paolo Pasqualoni machen in ihren Kommentaren nachher. Und wenn wir in die Diskussion kommen, brauchen Sie sich überhaupt keine Sorgen zu machen, wenn es irgendetwas gibt, was sehr kompliziert ist, was Sie sagen möchten und die Wörter nicht finden, dann sagen Sie es einfach auf Deutsch, weil ich kann natürlich problemlos übersetzen und andere auch hier im Raum. Und wenn irgendetwas ist, was der Jim sagt, in Beantwortung oder sowas, was Sie nicht verstehen, dann sagen Sie einfach so und dann halten wir, und das wird ja auch übersetzt. Das ist überhaupt kein Problem. Okay. My introduction to Jim's talk, and I should say, I, Lynn Chisholm, who works here at the Institute of Educational Sciences at Innsbruck, for those of you who don't know, Jim and I have known each other for how long now, Jim, do you think?
15
years or so.
Yeah.
I can't remember where we met.
Somewhere in Sweden.
I think this is what old married couples say to each other.
somewhere in Scandinavia, probably.
Somewhere. Anyway, yeah. It wasn't here. Huh? Yeah. Somewhere around the world, and that tells you something about both of us.
Or maybe Montreal.
Maybe it was
World Congress. Yeah?
Maybe that would be at the ISA, yeah.
Yeah, that would be 15.
So we share a long history because both of us are involved in international youth research and meet regularly at conferences and meetings in one way or the other. I have entitled what I want to say about him this evening as Strangers in What Used to Be Paradise. Jim Cote writes, he's recently written an autobiographical piece about his life and how he became a professor, which you might also like to read. And one of the things he writes near the beginning of this autobiographical piece is as follows. He says, "The events leading to and including an academic career have been far from typical. Working class background, Catholic upbringing, prodigal phase leading to high risk behavior and social exclusion, second chance and redemption, nose to the grindstone student, mentor researcher professor, interdisciplinary gadfly, and transdisciplinary conciliator. I was also the first in my bloodline to attend university, so was exceedingly unlikely to become a university professor. But he did indeed become one, always working between psychology, which is where he started, and sociology, which is where he ended up, and hence always trying to conduct interdisciplinary research, particularly with reference to youth transitions via the social psychology of identity formation and most recently as applied to young adults and higher education. Today he is a full professor of sociology at the University of Western Ontario in London, Canada. He writes prolifically. He edits two journals, one of which is called Identity, and the other one is the Journal of Adolescence. And he's currently my successor in the International Sociological Association Research Committee 34, which is the sociology of youth, in which I and Jim, and in fact Natalie Rechter, who is also here, she's also on the current committee in the ISA RC 34, we have all been involved for many years together on an international level. So he's currently the president of that research committee, but he also runs a blog under the name of ivorytowerblues.com, and he's a bit of a rock and roller, which you only find out, you know, in the more relaxed parts of the evenings. He has always tried to focus on the big picture that sets the parameters for the trajectories taken by people's lives, the opportunities and the obstacles set by the larger societal context that frame one's scope to reach one's potential. And in this sense, his interest focuses on the forgotten half. And that's a consequence of his own life course. And I would like to quote again a small piece from his autobiographical text in this context. He writes, "Making the transition from the working class to middle class professional life can be difficult. And subsequent life in the middle class is not necessarily a problem-free one in terms of managing deeply ingrained behavior and language patterns. Those who change social classes must learn many things as adults that are taken for granted by those whose primary socialization prepared them for their adult lives. Those who begin new lives in different social contexts are acutely aware of many things that others who have only known that only that one way of living take for granted." And so finding purpose in his academic life by wanting to understand how we can help those without the birthright, the forgotten half, to break through to reaching their potential. This is why Jim entitled his autobiographical piece, A Stranger in Paradise. This he drew from a book about academics from the working class, which was published in 1985. One or two of you may recall that 2 years ago, in our own Bildungstage, our own educational conference, educational science conference here at Innsbruck, I was introducing Karl-Heinz Gruber, who is a comparative educationalist here in Austria. He works in Vienna. And when I was looking up how to introduce him, I discovered that he and I had a lot in common, just like you and I, because both Karl-Heinz Gruber and I had been inspired in our own student days by the classic study and analysis, which is called Education of the Working Class, which was published by Jackson and Marsden in 1962 in England. So, in fact, I don't know whether the 1985 book knows about the 1962 book, but it will be interesting to make the connection. Yeah. There are innumerable points of similarity in Jim's origins and mine, and in our trajectories and in our destinations, and how we have tried to understand these and to weave their impact into our own academic work. And we have just made a plan for a book on exactly this, which we will do in the next couple of years. As I said earlier, Jim has an abiding commitment to interdisciplinary work, and he knows only too well what happens when one tries to live that commitment. On the one hand, you face what he calls disciplinary intransigence, particularly by older academics who have only ever known to live inside the legitimacy of one discipline. And you meet the incapacity of many academics to think outside the box. That is, they don't want to engage, or they refuse to engage with alternative points of view and to try to establish connectivities, which, when we were talking yesterday, we both agreed that critical analysis and thinking is not only about taking things to pieces, it's about putting things back together again. So it's about connectivities, and that's one of the very important kinds of competencies that people at university ought to have, or to learn to be able to have, and one of the problems is that they don't seem to be getting it so much as they used to. Probably the best known example of the outcomes of Jim's efforts in this kind of context is the so-called identity capital model. And this model tries to account for how young people actually negotiate and manage, that is, have agency in their multi-level and multifaceted identities in order to construct themselves and their lives in the transition to adulthood, particularly through educational pathways. And it's this kind of work that led him to look more closely at the phenomenon of student disengagement at university. And the questions he asks are really very simple. They are, what kind of phenomenon is this, student disengagement? Secondly, what is correlated with this phenomenon and what are possibly its causes? And thirdly, what can we do about it? So these issues and questions are of particular interest, I think, to us in Austria, given the truly desperate situation of our universities, especially in maths subjects like educational sciences, in which we all are. And that's why I began this introduction with the phrase, not a stranger in paradise, but strangers in what used to be paradise, but perhaps is no longer paradise. Over to you, Jim.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for that very kind introduction, and thank you all for coming today. I have a fair amount to say, and you'll be happy to know it's not about me. You've heard enough about me. Now we can turn to the work. As Lynn says, I became interested in this work sort of as part of a long line of interests. And in this case, the question is, given the amount of time, effort, and money we put into this institution that we call higher learning, how is it that so many people are not getting the full benefit from it? And I'm particularly concerned about those from lower income backgrounds, less affluent backgrounds, who are encouraged to go to institutions of higher education, and in many cases are extremely disappointed for what it has to offer. Many people in the system are very happy with it, and this is a problem in trying to initiate any changes. I'll go into this a bit as I go through the talk. I'll give you a few stories of how I've tried to introduce this to the public and to my colleagues. Now, the focus of the talk is more or less by necessity in Canada, where I'm from, and the United States. From the United States, that's where a lot of data has come from, and I think they were the first to really hone in on this problem, notice the problem, partly because I think they've led in the trends, particularly towards mass education, so they were the first ones doing it. And then they were the first ones noticing the problems. So they've developed a series of very large-scale studies, and I can draw off of that data. They've also been studying this, very nice for us, since the 1920s in some form or fashion, which allows for historical comparisons. So basically what we're going to look at is how the university system has evolved in Canada and the United States and in some other countries affected in a similar way. And I acknowledge that there are country differences, in some cases large country differences. In some cases the reason for the differences are different than those from other countries. It depends on the policies and that sort of thing. So I sort of beg your indulgence that some of what I say here, while it may apply to Canada and the United States, may not apply to Austria. And in that way, I'm hoping to learn from you to teach me what's going on in your country and what might be different here and what I might be able to take out of this. Now, the term student disengagement, it could be just called institutional disengagement, one of the problems with using this term student disengagement is immediately people have this reaction, like you're student bashing, like it's all students' fault that study hours have gone down. The term institutional disengagement would be better in that respect, but people would be confused by it. Basically, what I am arguing is that the institutional structure in higher education has changed the expectations that are related to students, and students are responding to those expectations. So it's an institutional or a structural matter that I'm looking at. It's not simply an individual response or a response of a generation. Now, at the same time, there are people within institutions, and you have individual reactions within those institutions. So there's the psychology and the sociology sort of put together. Students aren't to blame for the situation. It's an institutional matter, but students need to be aware of the situation, and if students are aware of the situation, then they can do something about it in their own lives, and therefore gain more out of their institutional experiences. So by bringing this to light, then students can help themselves. In my own teaching, and I teach hundreds of students every year, many students are very thankful that I do bring this to their attention. And they had no idea because the culture around them basically says that low levels of engagement are quite fine. It's quite normal to be like that. But there's so much more room for development that it's very good for them to know about this. So what I'm going to do is... Sorry, wrong one there. I'm a Mac user, sorry. I'll give you a brief outline, tell you where I'm going. First of all, I'm going to give you the empirical evidence, sort of the hard evidence, and I can move through this fairly quickly, but I'm going to try to speak slowly enough. If when I do speed up, just give me the signal to slow down. I'm going to look at the empirical research with respect to declines in study time over time and grade inflation, how grades have inflated over time. And this is a long period of time, about a century. And we're going to look at the issue of whether or not these two problems are interrelated. And I believe they are interrelated, and it has to do with academic standards in a variety of ways. Then I'm going to look at the various casual explanations that people have come up with this. I've spoken about this extensively in Canada, across the country, and in the national media and so forth, and gotten all sorts of reaction and feedback from people, and I'll sort of go over that with you, how people react to hearing about this. And then we'll get more academic about it, look at the plausible sociological explanations, and then I will end by presenting what I think to be fairly viable solutions, at least within the context that I operate within. Now, I'm not here to sell books. This first book was published in 2007. This is the one that created the stir in Canada and got many people talking about it. Ivory Tower Blues, and that's my website is named after this. And the second book was just out last year in 2011, Lowering Higher Education. It goes more at the issue of the corporatization of universities, sort of that the structural aspects of it, and how this is an assault on the liberal arts education. The liberal arts education being that sort of free thinking, teaching of critical thinking type of education, and how that is in jeopardy. And it also answers a number of the criticisms that people had of some of the points raised in Ivory Tower Blues. Now with the evidence. I hate to throw up charts with all of these numbers, so what I'm going to do is sort of direct you through it. And we gave handouts. Everybody managed to get a handout? Pretty much. Well, I'm going to show you what to take out of this. This first slide is about is based on diary use, and fortunately, studies have been done since the 1920s asking university students how much time they spent. This is total academic time, study time, and then time in class. So you can see the differences here, but I've highlighted two aspects here. This is academic time and study time. We go to 1928, 38.5 hours being total time in class and studying. Now, a full-time job in most countries is about 40 hours, so the idea of being a full-time student equates to about the same, about 40 hours. That's been thought of in those ways for some time. Study time, 21 hours. Now, fast forward to just a few years ago, and we see a dramatic drop on both of those. And if we look at all this, we can see that it's more or less a linear trend. So that's a qualitative way of looking at it. And by the way, this was by the authors Babcock and Marx, The Following Time Cost of College. You can just Google that, and it's a free study. You can go into a lot of stuff that they have to say. Here's their quantitative data. They took a look at a number of large-scale surveys. These only go back to the 1960s. And basically what they find is a steady decrease in study time since the 1960s. The largest decrease took place between the 1960s and the 1980s. And this is American data. This is the introduction of the mass education system, right? And I won't really explain a lot here. Adjusted for framing means the question wording, which is slightly different. They did studies on this, and they allowed for that. But there wasn't much variation in terms of wording. From the 1980s to the present, an additional 2 hours loss in study time. So it's been about a 10-hour loss in study time, according to these surveys, since the 1960s. So from 25 hours a week down to about 15 hours a week. Now, different studies show slight differences. I'll show you some differences. But the trend is robust. They looked at this in different ways. There's certainly no studies that show it going the other way, and this case with grade inflation as well. Now, what they did, this is the same study by Babcock and Marx. They took a look at different types of students in this slide. So those not working, those working less than 20 hours, those working 20 hours or more, and this is more or less family background in terms of income, parental education, and male and female. Now, first of all, the striking thing is that in all cases, there's a massive drop. In no category is anyone immune. But what I want to point out now, because this is going to come up several times, those who work more than 20 hours a week, back in 1961, they did have the lowest study time. But they basically dropped to the norm of the rest of their cohort. So study time really isn't an issue now in the way it was in the 1960s. Partly, I think, because of the overall drop in study time, there's just so much more free time now that it doesn't make a difference. So basically, the bar has been lowered for all if you take this at face value. They looked at different disciplines. Basically, you find the same thing. Engineering has the most study time, but they all dropped. In terms of types of schools, the two types of schools that have the highest number of study hours are the liberal arts, where there's just a bachelor's degree. They're four-year colleges in the U.S. The U.S. is really known for these. Intensive study, the profs tend not to do research. Students get a lot of attention and so forth. They dropped almost as much as everyone else. And the highly selective schools, like the Ivy League schools, they dropped considerably. Their students are putting out more effort, but certainly not stellar in that respect. So it's not the type of student that's involved here. It's not the type of school. So that's American evidence over time, historical evidence. Now, comparative evidence, this is very difficult to get, and I've only been able to find one study. This is a study carried out in the U.S. by HEPI, the Higher Education Policy Institute. And the concern there, and the reason why the study was carried out, was they were noticing in the U.K. as well a drop in study time. So these figures here are for study time and class time, the amount of time spent in class, amount of time studying. So you can see that in the U.K., they're at the low end. You see Austria is doing fairly well, almost in the middle, and France and Switzerland sort of leading the pack, if you will, still putting in the full 40-hour week or doing it full time. Now, the issue with putting in such low hours is, and these are all the full-time students, what we're getting to is getting to the point where full-time students are really treating school as a part-time job or part-time activity, right? So the less effort you put into something, the less you're going to get out of it personally. In Australia and New Zealand, the situation is apparently worse. They've taken the same instrument used by the Americans and adapted it to the Australian scene, and the students there are putting in less than 20 hours a week, class time and study time. So that's less than half the traditional value. And the universities are basically compliant in this. There's a complicity, it's part of the institutional culture that the universities have allowed to develop. Now, as I became more interested in trying to sort out exactly what was going on, I decided to buy a data set from the NESE. This is the National Survey of Student Engagement. Has anyone heard of this? National Survey of Student Engagement? Okay, they survey each year probably now over 100,000 students a year and up to 1,000 schools. And they surveyed in their first year and in their fourth year. And they've been doing this since 1999. So you have a large amount of data there, very, very consistent data. I purchased this from them so that I could compare Canada and the United States. Part of the problem that I had in getting the first book published was that the reviewers in Canada said, well, we all know that the education system is terrible in the US, but we've got a great one in our country. Right? Anybody heard that before? It's them, not us. And so it delayed the book. I had to dig in, go through university archives. Universities didn't want to. Information is difficult to get. The grade distributions, schools don't want to let that go public. So very few let me have it. My own university wouldn't even let me have this data. So finally got it. And I got these data. Now, I asked for 12,000 cases. And by the time I sorted through the data and only used full-time students, I have over 10,000 cases to do comparisons. So the slides you're going to be seeing now are based on full-time students who filled out the NESE survey. And what we find with three different types of schools in the United States and Canada, large schools, these are over 20,000 students, medium schools, 10 to 20,000, and small schools, under 10,000. Now, the school system in both countries is slightly different, so the comparisons aren't perfect, but we get an amazing similarity. Basically, what we have is that some 40% of students in both countries, in all the types of schools, are putting in 10 or fewer hours per week study time. Slightly higher percentage are putting in between 15 and 25 hours, but only about 10 to 12% are putting in 25 hours or more, which would make them full-time students if a full-time student is not defined in terms of paying tuition, but rather how much effort they put in to their work. Now, the mean study time, if you want to boil it down that way, the mean study time using these statistics is 12 to 13 hours per week in the US, 13 to 14 hours per week in Canada. Now, some historical evidence for grade inflation. Here's the source. You can go to this website. This fellow has dedicated himself to this issue. Again, digging into schools, he's gotten hundreds of schools to provide their data. But you can see over time that essentially the 2.3 is a C average. Common in Canada and the United States, it's a C was the average historically. That was satisfactory. You're doing a good job and you get a C. A B was very good, an A was excellent. So what's happened over time is the mean or median has gone from about 2.3, 2.4, or C, up to a B and it's pushing a B plus, especially in the private schools. Private schools in some jurisdictions are noted for their higher standards, but this seems to be changing as well in that parents are pushing more for extra advantage for their children. So make sure my children get higher grades. And I've spoken at a couple of private schools about this, and some are in a quandary as to whether or not to break the tradition and more or less bump up the grades arbitrarily to help their students to please the parents. So pretty robust data there. These are data that were published for Harvard University. This is a percentage of A's and B's, students getting A's and B's. Go back to 1920, only about 20% of students at Harvard got either an A or a B. So 80% got a C or lower. Well, you can see the line up. This line is drawn here. There's a slight difference in their grading system when they expanded somewhat. But you can see basically the same trend. And the issue comes up about elite schools, right? Harvard is an Ivy League school considered the best in the world by some for some things. I don't think for teaching. If you know anyone who's done an undergraduate degree there, you'll get a different story. But
I think you have to say what Ivy League is. Oh,
okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, try to stay away from those idioms. That's an American expression for the older schools with the they've been there long enough. They have Ivy.
Jim, you also have to make it clear that when you use the word school, you mean university.
Okay. Right. Sorry. Yeah, a good point. Yes, an English school is generic for all schools, but so Ivy League universities are the oldest universities, the most prestigious. They are the ones that hold the standard that everyone else wants to emulate.
Like Harvard, Yale.
Harvard, Yale, yeah, exactly, yeah. And this is the case of Harvard.
The other direction.
This is backed up on me. Okay. Now, Harry Lewis was a principal, or rather a dean at Harvard College. He was at Harvard for 32 years. After leaving, he was so disgruntled, so fed up with what was going on, that he wrote a book called Excellence Without a Soul. He says it still has the great reputation, but the undergraduates are being cheated, essentially. They are being cheated because their school and the professors are simply trying to make them happy rather than to educate them. So he devoted the whole book to this. And trying to make them happy in one way through higher grades. So over 90% of students are now awarded honors grades, A's and B's. So that's 90%. That's tremendous grade inflation. Summa cum laude, which used to be a distinction only those getting over 90%, and it would just be a few percentage of students could achieve that, would get this honor. Now so many were going over 90% that they limited it to 5%. Only 5% of the students could get that designation. But to distinguish it from the magna cum laude, they had to go to a cutoff at 3 decimal places. So you imagine how you would feel if you got a 92.563, but you needed 92.564 in order to get summa cum laude. So anyway, the problem here is that even at the elite universities, we're finding the same problem that we're finding at the mass universities, and the key seems to be something about keeping students happy rather than educating them. Now, for a comparative analysis, this goes back to the data set that I mentioned. We're basically finding the same thing in the general education system. So these are those three sizes of universities, Canadian, American universities. Only about 13% are getting C's. So that means, right, 87% are getting A's and B's. It's a little better in Canada, we're a little stricter in Canada, but not by much. So basically, the same thing is going on at places like Harvard, is going on in the smallest school with the sort of lowest standards. And this is a colleague in Canada put this up. This is more anecdotal. And I understand you don't use quite the same grading system here, but we face this. Going back to 1985 when I started teaching, you could handle grades like this and not get sort of a blowback, pushback, complaints. Not get complaints from students about giving a C. A C, quite happy. Go back another decade when I was a student myself. If I got a low B, hey, that's great. I thought I was doing very well. In fact, throughout my whole undergraduate career, I believe I might have got one or two A's, but I was considered a top student. So it's a massive change, 70s, 80s, and now we come to the present. Many Canadian students believe that an A plus is what they're after, means excellent. A is respectable. A B plus is only satisfactory, so it's traded places with a C. A B minus is scraping through, and a C plus is a failure. This is, students will launch full complaints overseas and this sort of thing. So there's an upward pressure now for giving higher grades that is more and more difficult for professors to sort of fight back against or to take their stand, and often administrations won't take the stand. I can go into all sorts of cases, but I've known of deans or chairs of department just give the whole class extra 10%, extra 20% because the professor in question graded too low, or so the students thought. Now, twin problem. George Kuh coined this term, the disengagement compact. He's the founder of the NESI. And he says there's a tacit agreement not to challenge each other to work harder between the teacher and the student. So here's basically what he says, what goes on typically in a professor's office. It doesn't have to be said anymore because it's a compact that everybody understands. But the student says, you give me at least a B for whatever I hand in, I'll give you peace of mind by not hassling you over the grades you assign me. Does that apply in Austria at all? No? Professors, I give you at least a B for whatever you hand in, and you won't ask me to take the time to justify the grades I assign. Anybody who's done any teaching and grading knows that the most difficult things to grade, most time-consuming, are the ones that are the worst, because there's so many mistakes. If something is well-written, you can read it, and you don't need to make many comments. Did you want to make a... Right. Well, it's understandable that people want high grades. What's that? There's more of a competition now for going on. I mean, the bachelor's degree has become a stepping stone for other things for many students. A lot of students just want the C and B, so I'm not talking about all students here, of course. Some are just happy to end with the bachelor's degree, but those who want to go on make it very clear that that's what they need. But what we have here is really an institutional consent for a culture of disengagement. And this is where I'm going with this. The dean of my faculty, after he left the year before Ivory Tower Blues was published, he heard me on the national radio and he came to my office and he said, congratulations for, I won't use his language, but for standing up against administration. All the time he was dean, not one professor came in and gave him any sort of hell or any sort of cogent argument as to why the system should change or be standards should be upgraded. Nobody would stand up to him, right? They're all shy and sheepish, oh, shucks, sort of thing. And this is his quote. Administrators let them in because they want a lot of students because they make more money for the university and the Canadian system the more students you have, but professors let them out. So that's kind of where the system is. And I should say the NESI studies show that in defense of students come to our universities expecting to be challenged more, expecting to have to do more work in first year, and they find that they get very little challenge, These are very dumbed down sort of textbooks that don't require a lot of independent thinking. It's just memorization and looking at glitzy pictures and so forth and doing multiple choice tests. So they figure out ways of spending the least amount of time on this undesirable activity, which most people would do. So that kind of sets the stage for this downward spiral that we're talking about, where the standards go down, the professors find that they don't want to push because they get this criticism from the students back. Now, effort and grades, the more effort you put into something in a course, you should get a higher grade, right? And it should be a fairly strong correlation, right? You would think. Well, and if you know any statistics, you'll know that a correlation of 0.15 is not a strong correlation. In fact, you know, it's just... No, it's not even worth really considering it at such a low level. And you can see why. There's one real good reason for this. Anybody into statistics? Well, what's happened is that grades have compressed. You have fewer data points. So basically, the variance is just between A and B. And there's very little difference across the categories. So you get this very low correlation. Basically, everybody gets the same grades, unless you really screw up somehow, unless you're... And, you know, like you don't study at all. You don't hand in assignments. And you can do all sorts of things. Anyway, that's another sideline. But it takes a lot to get failed out of a Canadian or an American university. Everything is done to try to keep you going. And, you know, okay, here, just take this grade and be gone with you, that sort of thing. But anyway, these two numbers here, 10 or fewer hours per week work. For 55% of students, this can still get them a B. For a quarter, it can still get them an A. And I'll just go through this quickly because we're moving on. This is just to show some local things. Notice the drop in attendance. I don't know, in Austrian high schools, this is at the high school level. Is attendance required? It used to be. Well, it's not in Canadian schools. You can see it drops below 50% by grade 12. This is regular attendance. Doesn't mean that 50% of the class are absent each day, but the pattern of participation is such that only about 40-some percent regularly attend their classes. And then intellectual engagement drops as well. There's different ways of measuring student engagement. And I'll just run through this, since you don't use grading here, but this shows the grade inflation. Back in the early 60s, only between 5 and 10% of high school students would get an A. And then at the end of the 60s, they got rid of what was called the departmental exam. It was a standardized exam set by the Ministry of Education that everyone had to pass in order to graduate. Once they got rid of that, grades started to inflate because it was the teacher who taught the student who's also evaluating the student. There's an incestuous thing about that we don't talk about. But when you have board exams and someone else is doing the grading objectively, then you usually get a different mark, and it's usually a lower mark. But anyway, the trend continued. University applicants were the averages. The figures I got by 2004, 61% of those applying to universities had A's. A pluses were rare at the secondary school level until the last couple of decades now, but 1 in 6 are applying with an A plus average. So there's that rare A plus that Harvard would give for the very top students. Now you have 1 in 6 high school students graduating with that in Ontario. A little personal anecdote here. This is my own school. I was first there in the 70s, and this was as a TA, this is the grade distribution we were given. Introductory courses should be in the range of 64 to 67, and then they're allowed to go a bit higher, 30 to 40% A's and B's, and then allowed to go higher with these higher level courses. This is a master's level course. You're still supposed to give a B average in a master's level course. Doing that now would have the student removed from the program. But the university did give me access to their institutional data. There's way too much here to explain. But I'll just take one faculty. Going back to the mid-1970s, in the science faculty, they were following that grade guideline I just showed you fairly well. And they followed it through with some variation until the late 90s, when a new funding formula for students was introduced, enrollment contingent funding. This meant that departments were paid by the number of students they have in each course. And if you don't have enough students, you don't get that money, so you have to let people go, right? Rather than the old funding formula where, okay, this is a discipline, you need a certain set of resources for people to be able to teach it properly, and here's the money. Well, what that did, amongst other things, it created a competition among faculties and departments for students. So we see, go down here for the latest figures, from 42% in first year to 64% A's and B's. So this is now up to the B average, and same with the science faculty. And some of the departments did this on purpose. They looked at the distribution of grades and they said, we're losing students, the economics department especially, we're losing students, so we're just going to inflate our grades. Everybody give higher grades, let's start now. And in about 5 years, they got their students back. So that's one of the things that type of funding introduces to the problem. Now, just another brief run through of this. We go to the individual level, the psychological level. We have this institutional structure imposed on students. Students are different, they have different attitudes and so forth. One such attitude that the researchers called academic entitlement was measured. They came up with a 15-item scale and gave these items. If I've attended most classes for a course, I deserve at least a grade of B, so one-third. So just showing up. A professor should be willing to lend me his or her class notes if I ask for them. One-quarter. I would think poorly of a professor who didn't respond the same day to an email message I sent. 1 in 6. Guilty, guilty, guilty. Now, there's a negative correlation. Those who have this orientation, there's a negative correlation with their work orientation and their pro-social attitudes, and a positive correlation with they're more extrinsically motivated and they're more likely to cheat. So that's an American study. This is a Canadian study where they called it degree purchasing. Now, Canadian students are lucky enough to pay tuition. One difference from here in Austria, students in Quebec don't seem to like to pay tuition. You might have heard something on the news about that recently. They've taken to the streets the last 4 months. But anyway, the rest of Canadian students pay tuition. It's fairly high, and it doubled about 20 years ago. So that had an effect. That sort of changed a lot of students' attitudes about things. And these researchers looked at it and said, well, okay, some students look at the degree as a ticket to a job. I'm here not to learn, I'm here because I want a job. And other students may have this attitude, or may not, but they're here because they have to be. Their parents say they have to be, there's no jobs for them, and learning is unimportant, I know it all anyway, what can this teacher tell me? So the research shows that this attitude itself undermines its own goals. It correlates with poor study habits, lower grades, classroom resistance behaviors, which I won't go into. If you've taught large classes, you'll know about the passive aggressiveness and so forth of students, and various negative emotions. And this is from their study, their path diagram. Basically, they ordered it this way. Those who see the degree as a ticket, it's related to seeing learning as unimportant. The correlation coefficient, or that would be a beta coefficient there, is 0.43. And you can see these are related to all sorts of things that work against getting higher grades. So it works against their sort of goal of getting a good job, right? Get better grades, you should be able to get a better job. So they don't process information as much. They have poor study habits. They procrastinate. They engage in these resistant behaviors with their profs, and they have more negative affect. And then that, again, translates to lower grades. Now, that's just a snapshot of the types of things that's going on and the various reactions that students have had. Students are human beings wanting to adapt to various systems, and there are various types of students. Now, and we need to keep this in mind in coming up with explanations. Now, the people I've spoken with over time have come up with some of the following. It's unrealistic to expect mass systems to do better. This really hits home with a lot of people. Okay, first of all, when you go to a mass system, you're bringing in more people, so the ability level will go down, so you have a wider range of ability, so you shouldn't expect much more. You're bringing in people who really aren't necessarily as motivated as people used to be, so why would you expect them to be motivated, right? Should we just leave it at that? Well, this goes back to what Lynn was saying about my approach. I think we should not leave it at that. What we need to do is look at the system and say, well, let's do something about the system that has created this problem. We should have in our minds the metaphor, the idea that our policy should create a tide that lifts all boats. If we're going to put people through this experience, we should at least make it worth their while, and we should help them to develop themselves personally and intellectually, as well as develop work skills to do the whole bit. So this requires backing off on that disengagement compact and trying to do our best for everyone, not just let people slough through. So that goes to the question of what really is the purpose of higher education. If you want to just leave it at that, we're admitting that we really have a credentialist system, and that's all that is important is the credential. The term in English is credential mill, credential factory. It's always been like this is another defense. Well, we looked at the historical data, and that simply isn't the case. Professors are bad teachers. True? Well, like all other human beings, there's variation. There are some good teachers, there's some bad teachers, there's great variation. But I'll show you a student survey, satisfaction survey in a minute. Most students rate their professors very highly. So students aren't complaining about that. But the thing that's often missed in this is that higher education should be about students taking some responsibility for their learning. And in the traditional system, the student and the teacher meet each other halfway. The teacher doesn't do all the work for the student and say, here's 100 things you need to know to write this essay. Don't do any thinking yourself. This is what you need to know. Or here's 100 things you need to know to write this test. Don't think anything beyond it. Just if you can regurgitate those 100 things, I'll give you 100%. Well, that's the training model. If you're studying to be a doctor, a surgeon, and you needed to know 100% of the procedures to open up the stomach and close it properly, then you might want to take that stand. But if you're doing a critical analysis of something, developing an argument where there are no right or wrong answers, it's an entirely different system of education. How about this one? Students are smarter now. How many vote yes for that? Well, this is the so-called Flynn effect, and it's an interesting one because it is true that standardized IQ tests, since the time that they were developed about 100 years ago, every couple of decades, they have to renorm them, put in different questions, because successive cohorts score higher on them. Does this mean they're getting smarter, or there's something about the test? Well, if they are getting smarter, then this would mean, if you backtrack, go back 100 years, our grandparents were basically would be have an IQ level too low to go to high school. So it's something about the test. The thing is, the test questions are part of the zeitgeist, and they're practice. They're sort of, the more you are used to thinking in a certain type of rationality, you're no longer problem solving. You're simply repeating a procedure that you've learned. Technology saved time. We've got all these great technologies, laptops, iPhones. Everybody have one all turned off? Yeah. Well, there's a number of problems with this argument. First of all, reading and thinking, technology hasn't quite solved that one yet. And that's what takes up about 90% of study time, right? Technologies make writing essays easier. You can do the research quicker, use a word processor, get through it quicker. But there are fewer essays now in mass systems. In my school, people are fleeing, or have been fleeing essays the last 10 years. And students hate them, professors hate them. So the technology isn't helping there much at all. And in fact, the technologies can be very much distractions. If you do some surveys of the amount of time students spend texting, Facebooking, and so forth, and add up all those hours of the day, maybe that's what's cutting into some of the study time, rather than.
Tell them what you do in your classes.
So my classes, no laptops, cell phones off the desk, because all the rooms have Wi-Fi, and I can't control that. After every 50 minutes, every 50 minutes, I say, now 10 minutes for texting. And most of the students bring out their phones or their laptops, and in 10 minutes, most people can get their texting done that will get them through to the next hour. And the final nail in this explanation is that 8-hour decline that the American studies found between 1960 and 1980, most of the decline in study time happened then. Well, guess what? There weren't any iPhones before 1980. There weren't any laptops. So most of the drop in study time happened before these technologies came along. Students are too busy now, especially because of higher tuition. May not apply here. Maybe a higher standard of living. Have to do more paid work. So I examined this as well in the study where I bought the data from the NESI. And took this apart. This is a lot to throw at you, but this red line is hours per week working, and for those who don't do any work, they score it at about a 4.5. Here's the scaling here, and the 4.5 is about 13.5 hours a week. And we go along here. Those who are doing 30 or more hours a week work, their number of hours in study time is 11. So it's only about a 3-hour difference between not working at all and working over 30 hours in study time. Socializing, the blue line is socializing, it takes up about 7 hours. I also looked, here's what I just talked about here, but I also looked at other things, single mothers caring for dependents, those who are working on campus. These tend to be more career-related jobs, those in co-curricular activity and sports and so forth. All of these were either had no relationship with study time or a positive relationship. Single mothers study more. Those who are sports-oriented in sports clubs study more. The sort of prototypical disengaged student is the young male living in residence, has no responsibilities. Very little structured time, and is away from home for the first time. So, the sort of casual explanations don't really hold up much water. The sociological ones are more difficult to evaluate. And I'll just run through these quickly. I know I'm taking a bit more time than I meant to. But Martin Trow is... Okay. Martin Trow, is he known?
Yeah. Well, I know him, but I don't know.
Well, his theory of going from elite to mass to universal education, mm-hmm. He would argue we're in the universal phase.
This work is not known here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll leave it. But this is basically the idea that if as soon as you introduce more people into the system, the ability level is going to go down, mm-hmm. So you can't expect more, really. You've got a really wider range of students to teach, and many are just not as teachable as those with the higher abilities. There's also the Americanization of education, where it's the great equalizer. Send everybody to school, and they will, if they go far enough, they'll live happily ever after and become rich and famous, that sort of thing. Now, there's the political economy view. Revolt of the Elites was written by Christopher Lash about 20 years ago. Basically, his argument is that the wealthiest people in most Western societies have resisted to pay tax. They've done everything they can to get their tax rates lowered, especially in the United States, but especially corporations. Countries around the world are in competition with each other to lower corporate tax rates. In Canada in the 1950s, 50%, the corporate tax rate was 50%, and now it's less than 20%. So a lot of that money that the government no longer gets from corporations cannot go into education and so forth. So basically in an era of retrenchment or lower budgets. Budgets have been lowered every year I've taught since 1984. Every year. Now, add to this neoliberalism getting its foot in the door with Thatcher and Reagan in the 1980s, we have sort of a paradox of accountability here. The neoliberal view is a very right-wing view. It wants accountability. We don't want you just sort of teaching this willy-nilly. That probably doesn't work. Teaching the... okay. We don't want you teaching soft stuff. We want hard stuff, and we want to make sure that everybody is working their 40 hours a week, and we want accountability. We want you to measure everything and make sure that everybody's towing the line. Well, this creates a pseudo-vocationalism so that it puts sociology on the spot. We have to come up with sociology courses that have some sort of promise of getting the student a job rather than teaching them critical thinking. So criminology is very important. It's very popular now. So you have really the problem there is you have less human capital production, less skill production, and less learning. The states have intervened more and more in many countries and developed different types of managerialism. The UK is the worst example of this, but it's Canada is stepping in. I don't have time for those examples. But when the state moves in, they tend to have a poor oversight of standards, and you just get into the credentialist model. They want to graduate as many people as possible. They want as many people in the schools and out of the labor force so they don't have to put them on the dole, pay them unemployment insurance, and they can pay their way through schools. And that just feeds credentialism. And then the corporatization, the universities themselves become self-sustaining corporations, and they have to survive all this underfunding. So they take up these branding initiatives. Each school in North America now has its own particular brand. They hire consultants, spend millions on this, and they build big buildings around campus with spas and sports complexes and so forth. And finally, there's a cultural, and this is at back to a macro level. And speaking here, especially of the United States, I don't think anyone will be insulted if I call it an anti-intellectual culture and highly hedonistic. And this too feeds into the culture of the university. And so when we go to the macro level, We can sort of put the picture together like this. At this historical moment, I would argue that we're giving a BA light. The institutions are conferring, in full knowledge, a BA light. You can get your BA part-time. You don't have to put a lot of work into it. You pay your tuition, you'll get it. That's the deal. It's most severe in countries with Americanized secondary systems and the sort of spoon feeding at the secondary system or the high school system with high grades, no homework, spreads to the tertiary system. So they haven't had homework in high school. Why should I have homework at university? And I always got an A, so why am I not getting an A now? So that spreads to universities. The low level of engagement is rewarded with high grades across all institutions and all student types. So we have there the institutional aspect of it. Now the political aspect of it, putting those last points together, there's a paradox of neoliberal managerialism where you have mass systems with poor stewardships under conditions of underfunding. So you put it all together, you got a real soup. Borscht. it's a real mess to try to sort out. And you have all sorts of different people with different interests that they want to protect, and they don't want it to change. Right, the system that is there, it's as bad as it is, it's better than what they don't know might be coming. So you end up with lower standards and quality as an unintended consequence of efficiency and accountability. This goes back to the neoliberal part. The efficiency is quantity of students over quality. Let's pump out as many students as we can. There's all sorts of propaganda about why we should do this. But schools end up being vendors of soft credentials to mass consumers. Accountability, teaching evaluations. You have those in Austria?
Yes.
These are also this great rise in grade inflation. There's a strong association between teaching evaluations. Teaching evaluations, on the one hand, absorb student discontent. So when a student is not happy with the university, with their education, they can take it out on their individual instructors and bomb them on their evaluations, feel good about it, but still feel good about their overall experience. Well, I had fun when I was here, you know. The other stuff isn't so bad, but that, oh, that, you know, that Cote, I never want to take another course from him again. And essentially what happens is customer satisfaction trumps educational standards. So we end up with a system where, and this is back to the students in the room, you're not complaining. Where are the complaints about this? The customers are not complaining. Only 3% of students say that their entire educational experience at this institution was poor. That's that survey with about 10,000 students all over Canada, the United States, all different types of institutions. And it doesn't, I looked at different types of institutions, it's all the same. Most are pretty happy, excellent and good. And of course, the governments publish these stats and say, there's nothing wrong with our universities. The students like them, right? They're the customers, they're getting what they want. Why should we do anything about it? Now, I have a few solutions, but I think I'm over time. So why don't we leave it there, and or shall I?
It depends how long the solutions take.
OK, well, since everyone has them written down in front of them, I will just briefly go over them.
Yeah.
OK, I know I'm already speaking too quickly to get through this, but OK, this is solutions a la Cote that. From what I've put together, this is one way out of it. I'm not coming up with these saying they're realistic, that anybody's going to agree with them, especially in the neoliberal era where there's so much propaganda going the other way. The manufacture of consent of the elites is pushing all the ideologies the other way. But I think the liberal arts are worth saving. And what I mean by the liberal arts are those disciplines that teach critical thinking, the ability to analyze arguments, not simply criticize, but to analyze the benefits and drawbacks of particular points of view and to come up with your own argument or point of view and to be able to talk about it and write about it. That is the value of the bachelor's level education. If you can do that, you can actually teach yourself for the rest of your life. You're an empowered individual. And that's the only way that I think we're going to be able to turn the tide against things like neoliberalism. So that's why I think it's worth at least considering these, even if they will be dismissed as unrealistic. So liberal education should be about critical thinking, not pseudo-vocational training. Funding should not be enrollment-based. A 15-to-1 maximum student-teacher ratio. Grade distribution should be system-wide. Across the country, like in Canada, we have a problem. We have 10 provinces. We have a different ministry in each province. They have different standards. But there needs to be something to step in to say what these standards are. And there's all sorts of ways, all sorts of systems that could be developed. Entrance and exit exams to universities run by the disciplines that set the standards. So in sociology, similar to what law would do in setting its exams, sociology would do, education would do. So each discipline has its own control over things. And this is one of the things that's happened at the administrative level is the disciplines have lost control. And these are not just multiple choice tests. They're about your ability to write and speak. Teaching evaluation should be about student engagement. How engaged were you in this course? How much did you grow as a person? What are your personal outcomes? Not consumer satisfaction. And you would get a totally different story in terms of what governments could be handed in terms of their evidence of whether or not we should do something about this. And some people aren't going to like this. I'm not sure what the situation is in Austria, but in Canada and the United States, One reason why people go into administration is that they're mediocre researchers, lousy teachers. But administration doesn't look too bad. And many of our administrators have never been in a class in the last 15, 20 years. In the first book, Ivory Tower Blues, I quote someone who was a chair, a dean, and a vice provost. And when he went back into the classroom, he was shocked. He wrote a paper about it just to relate his feelings. He lost touch. He thought everything was fine because his underlings are telling him everything's okay. And there's no real connection from the classroom to those at the higher level. So administrators should keep teaching at least something within their discipline, just especially at the first year level and the upper year level, just so they can monitor what's going on and make sure that the mission is on course. And I'll leave it there. A few minutes over.
Thank you.
Thank you.